Good afternoon, everyone. In 1976, Arnold Toynbee published his last book, entitled Mankind and Mother Earth. We now stand at a turning point in the history of the biosphere, he wrote. It looks as if man will not be able to save himself from the nemesis of his demonic material power and greed, unless he allows himself to undergo a change of heart. But such a change of heart, Toynbee warned, would need the motivation generated by religion. Of course, he was not looking for a religious revival of the traditional supernaturalist kind. He regarded religion as being, in his words, the human being's necessary response to the mysteriousness of the phenomena he encounters. And indeed, that is how all religion began. But how will such a spirituality arise in this global secular age? And from where will it come? No religion has ever been invented from scratch. It has always evolved out of what has preceded it. So any future religion will arise out of the faiths of the past. But not only from Christianity and Islam and the like, but also from the pre-axial religions which preceded them. Just as the Protestant reformers, setting out to reform the church, went back to what they took to be primitive Christianity, so likewise, we need to go back even further to the pre-axial religions. And when we do this, we find, perhaps to our surprise, that they have never been wholly eliminated. Indeed, under the surface of the various later layers of Christianity, there still remain the remnants of religion that focused on nature. For example, tucked away in an obscure corner of many of a European cathedral is the sculptured representation of the green man who symbolized the spirit of nature. And more obviously, we still name the days of the week after the ancient Germanic gods: Sunday for the sun god, Monday for the moon god, Wednesday for Woden, Saturday for Saturn. Now these relics remain in spite of the efforts of priests to eliminate them as superstitious paganism. The devotees of monotheism were so anxious to reject the gods of nature that they disconnected the human species from the world of nature, and they focused attention on the human species alone. Much of our trouble, says the Catholic priest Thomas Berry, has been caused by our limited modes of thought. We centered ourselves on the individual, on personal aggrandizement, and a sense of the planet Earth never entered our minds. Christianity taught us to fasten our attention on heaven above and to regard the earth as a fallen world doomed for ultimate destruction. And that's why during the medieval period, so many people withdrew from this world into monasteries and convents to prepare themselves spiritually for their ultimate salvation elsewhere. And even when Protestantism closed the monasteries and took a giant step towards the secularizing of Christianity, they still saw the world as a place where the devil trapped the careless and the unsuspecting. And that attitude is clearly manifested in fundamentalism to this day, and is the reason why fundamentalism regards the greening of Christianity as doing the work of the devil. But even so, theologians of the caliber of Emil Brunner warned against giving too much attention to the world of nature. Because man has been created in the image of God, he said, therefore he may and should make the earth subject to himself. He should have dominion over all other creatures. Man is only capable of realizing his divine destiny when he rises above nature. 70 years ago. It's not surprising, therefore, that it has been left chiefly to secular prophets and stirrers outside of the church to take the lead in re-evaluating the earth and teaching us how to care for it. So just as Paul claimed 2,000 years ago that God has chosen the foolish and the world to shame the wise, in today's context we could observe Mother Earth now relies on the lefties and the greenies and the despised heretics to shame the leaders of officialdom. Now, the very first greenie, as we've already noticed, was the man now honoured as St. Francis. And he pioneered the greening of Christianity back in the 13th century. Of course, his references to nature were still enfolded within the context of giving due honour to the Heavenly Father. But we are now free, as he was not, to give our full attention to the immense universe itself, to the mystery of life, to our dependence on the forces of nature. And that is just what some theologians, such as Gordon Kaufman and Sally McFaig, are now setting out to do. In her book, Super, Natural Christians, How Should We Love Nature?, Sally McFaig reconnects the Christian tradition with the natural world. And it is no accident, by the way, that some of the first theologians to attempt to expound a green theology have been women. We could also mention Rosemary Radford Ruther, Karen Armstrong, Anne Primavasi. Now, perhaps there's no better way to reconnect Christianity with the natural world than to examine the major Christian festivals and trace them back to their origins in nature. Because all of our festivals were originally prescribed to fit the movements of the heavenly bodies, and these, you remember, were once worshipped as deities. Have you ever noticed, by the way, how the monotheists who composed the first chapter of the Bible deliberately downgraded the sun and the moon? First, by declaring them to be created, and second, by stating that their creation did not take place until the fourth day. And how could there be 3 days without the sun? That was a real put down for the sun, you see. Now, the waxing and waning of the moon and the changing path of the sun, dividing the passing of time into days, months, and years, determined the framework for all religious celebrations. Now, the sun and the moon remain just as much time markers for us as they were for primitive humankind. Indeed, our very bodies have biological clocks built into them, and these we have tended to ignore for too long. The daily, monthly, and annual festivals keep us in tune with the rhythms of the earth and may well play an important role in promoting our physical and mental health. So the attempt to focus on these rhythms by some health programs and New Age cults is not quite so outlandish as they may appear. So the oldest festivals we know of are those that celebrated the new year and the appearance of the new moon. And in the biblical tradition, the festival of the new moon was particularly important, and we hear a great deal of it in the Old Testament. But the prophets saw it as a relic of nature worship, and tried to stamp it out. So Isaiah vigorously declared that God hated the new moon festivals and found them a wearisome burden. It's interesting to find that the new moon celebrations had actually lasted as late as the time of Isaiah, because their origin goes back at least to the Hebrew patriarchs who lived a semi-nomadic life. The moon not only provided light for travel at nighttime in the desert, but it always seemed more kindly than the sun with its burning heat. Now, it was much the same for the people of Arabia, and that is why the month has remained the dominant segment of time in Islam. The Islamic world has never adopted the solar year, and to this day lives by the lunar year of 12 months, even though it's 11 days shorter than the solar year. The fact that the lunar and solar cycles do not neatly fit each other has always been a problem for cultures. Now, we have long solved this problem by dividing the solar year into 12 months of unequal numbers, which we have trouble remembering sometimes. And this disengages our months from the true lunar cycles. The people of ancient Israel solved the problem differently, and in a way that has remained Jewish practice to this day. They observed a year of 12 lunar months, like Islam. But unlike Islam, they adopted the Babylonian system of introducing a 13th month nearly every third year in order to realign it with the true solar year. The ancient Hebrews first learned to come to terms with the solar year when they entered Canaan and fused with them to become the people of Israel. Then they had to accommodate themselves to a predominantly agricultural culture, and that was closely adjusted to the solar year. The Israelites continued to observe the lunar year, as the many references to the new moon festival show, but at the same time they adopted the divisions of the solar year as practiced by the Canaanites. Now, the Canaanites appear to have developed a very complex calendar, which divided the year into seven periods of 50 days. And that is now known as the Pentecontad calendar. Each Pentecontad consisted of 7 times 7 days plus one. The reason being that the number seven was sacred. Sacred partly because of the four almost 7 day phases of the moon, and partly because there were seven planets. So these seven Pentecontads followed New Year's Day with 2 7 day interludes, one after the fourth and the other after the seventh Pentecontad. Now, I mention the Pentecontad calendar only because remnants of it have survived to this day. First, in the 7 day week. Secondly, in the 50 day period between Easter and Pentecost. And thirdly, in the year of Jubilee, the 50th year. But what has also survived from ancient Canaanite practice were the agricultural festivals. The festival of unleavened bread at the spring equinox, the first fruits 50 days later, and the ingathering of the harvest in the autumn. And what the Israelites gradually did was to disengage these festivals from their original connection with nature and turn them into commemorations of basic events in their own history. So unleavened bread became the Passover, celebrating the deliverance from Egypt. First fruits became Pentecost, celebrating the giving of the Torah on Mount Sinai. The ingathering retained the name booths or tents, but came to celebrate the long trek through the wilderness. Now, as Christianity emerged out of Judaism, it carried on with the first two festivals, and it turned them into Christian festivals. Because Jesus had been crucified in the Passover season, this originally spring festival became the commemoration of his death and resurrection. The Jewish Pentecost, originally the festival of first fruits, became the commemoration of the coming of the Holy Spirit. And in the course of time, Easter celebrations became the most important of all Christian festivals, Good Friday being the holiest day of the year, and Easter Day the most joyous. But what is too often lost sight of is the fact that the Easter festival has never entirely shed the practices which betray its origin as a spring festival, whether in Canaan or in Europe. In Western Christianity, for example, we still call it Easter, which is the name of the pagan goddess of East, of spring. And what is more, and often to the chagrin of Christian clergy, the most widespread symbols still appearing at Easter today in this secular age are Easter eggs and Easter bunnies. They survive as a reminder of the very ancient spring festivals which long preceded Jewish Passover and the Christian celebration of the death and resurrection of Jesus. So if we wish to reconnect Christianity with nature and foster the kind of religion Toynbee called for, there is no better way than to turn back to the origin of our major festivals. The ecological spirituality of the future will celebrate the wonder of the universe and the mystery of life. It will focus on the natural processes which have brought life into being. It will encourage people to be grateful for the richness of the natural world and to respond positively to the ecological imperative now laid upon us. So let us look at what we may do, turning first to Easter. Easter has sometimes been regarded by Christians as the miraculous return of a dead man to life. Well, even Bishop David Jenkins said, "That's a travesty of Easter that turns it into a piece of cheap science fiction." Easter is very much greater than that. Well, 35 years ago, I wrote a book called Resurrection, A Symbol of Hope, in which I traced the long story of the real Easter message. The real Easter message is not unique to Christianity. It permeated the religion of the ancient Middle East long before. Christianity did not even create the Easter message. Rather, it used it in order to interpret the tragic death of Jesus in positive terms of hope. The essential message of Easter is this. We can put it in the form of a paradox. All life ends in death, but out of death also comes new life. Now, this theme of death, followed by resurrection, found expression in the ancient Middle East in the stories of the gods, stories we now call myths. And chief among them was the Easter story of the dying and rising God. The reason the ancients told these stories is that that is how they experienced life. They saw the sun die every day in the west and then rise again with new life the next morning. They saw the moon wax and wane every month, and then for a short time it couldn't be seen at all. But on the third day, the new moon appeared. And that, by the way, is the origin of the well-known biblical phrase, on the third day. And then they noted the seasons of the year. The summer fruiting was followed by the autumn harvesting, and then by the dying of vegetation in the winter. But in spring, what seemed to be dead sprang into life again. And that's why the Easter festival, of course, was celebrated in spring. In spring more than at any other time, death was being followed by resurrection to new life. And not only in vegetation. Human life also ends in death. We too flourish like the grass and wither and die, as the psalmist observed. But as each generation passes away, it is succeeded by a new generation. Death and resurrection are built into the very fabric of all life on earth. And this is the way Easter was celebrated for many centuries by the peoples of the ancient Middle East. And the ancient Israelites reflected it in their own writings. Hear these words from Hosea. After 2 days he will revive us. On the third day he will restore us to life, and we will come alive in his presence. That's the Easter message, back in Hosea. But the Israelites seized upon this theme in order to interpret their own history. So when they faced near extinction by being overrun by powerful empires from Mesopotamia, Ezekiel expressed the hope for Israel's resurrection in the well-known vision of the Valley of Dry Bones. These bones, he says, are the house of Israel. But behold, God says, I will open your graves and raise you from your graves, and I will put my spirit within you, and you shall live. The Easter renewal, observed in the natural world, is what the prophet now applied to the ongoing destiny of his people. So the application of the Easter message, once started, came to the fore every time the people of Israel faced new threats. In the middle of the second century before Christ, the Greek rulers tried to destroy the Jewish people and stamp out their traditions. And that's when the book of Daniel was written. And in that book we read, there shall be a time of great trouble, but your people shall be delivered, and those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, and the wise among them shall shine again like the stars forever. And so the Easter faith, the resurrection from the dead, was being much talked about in Jewish circles at the beginning of the Christian era, and Jesus himself was immersed in it and debated it with his fellow Jews. So when he himself died on the cross as a martyr, his followers already had to hand the appropriate language with which to express their conviction that all that Jesus was and had come to mean for them just could not die. Jesus was not dead, he was alive. But he was alive in a new way. He was alive in them. And that's why Paul, our earliest witness to the resurrection of Jesus, put it so eloquently when he said, it's no longer I who live, it's Christ who lives in me. And that's why Paul came to speak of the community of Christians who shared this experience. He called them the body of Christ. The historical Jesus had died, but all that he stood for was very much alive. The church itself was the embodied, risen Christ. Now you may think that the Easter experiences of the first Christians was of an order quite different from the nature festivals of the past. But the first Christians didn't see it that way. That's why we find the writer of the fourth gospel putting these words into the mouth of Jesus. Truly I tell you, unless a grain of wheat falls into the earth and dies, it remains alone. But if it dies, it bears much fruit. And listen to how Clement, one of the very early popes of Rome, put it. Let us observe, he says, how the Creator is continually displaying resurrection, of which we find an example in the raising of the Lord Jesus Christ from the dead. But let us look at the resurrection that happens regularly all the time. Day and night shows a resurrection, he says. The night goes to sleep, the day rises. The day departs, and night comes on. Let us take the crops, he says. How does the sowing happen, and in what way? The seed falls into the ground and dies. But then from the death of one grain, by the mightiness of divine providence, there grows more fruit. So if even the early Christians could see that the rising of Jesus from the dead was all of a piece with the death and resurrection to be observed within nature, how much more are we free to do the same? Today, we humans can not only observe that life on this planet has an awe-inspiring capacity to keep renewing itself, but the evolution of life in all its innumerable forms out of this once lifeless planet is itself the greatest resurrection miracle of all. And even that is not all. As astronomers now begin to unfold to us the marvels and mystery of our evolving cosmos, they tell us that the earliest galaxies and stars did not yet have within them the chemical elements such as carbon necessary for life. And before these more complex elements could even be created, it was necessary for the type of star known as a supernova to explode and die. And it is out of the fragments of dying supernovas that later the planets and the higher chemical elements came to be born. Well, that's death and resurrection on the grand scale. Thus, the universe itself is deeply permeated by the basic Easter phenomenon of death and resurrection. The Easter theme of life out of non-life, of life, death, and resurrection to life, has been there from the beginning of time. It's basic to the nature of the universe. It's basic to all life on this planet. And that is something that calls for continual celebration. So what an opportunity there is in this ecological age for green Christianity to restore to the Easter celebrations its original and eternal message. And it is something that can give us hope as we face an ecological crisis. Because just as our own bodies show a remarkable capacity to recover after illness and disease, so the earth has a remarkable capacity to recover, to regain its stability, to renew itself. And we can take heart from the fact that the creative forces within us, within nature, within the universe itself, are of such a kind that a new earth can yet be resurrected out of the death that we humans are currently bringing upon it. Easter, thus celebrated, can revive in us a hope for a worthwhile future for this planet. Now let's turn to Christmas. For some 1500 years, the 25th of December has been celebrated as the birthday of Jesus Christ. But of course, that's not how it started. It's now widely accepted that we don't know even the day or the year in which Jesus was born, even though for some 1500 years we have celebrated Christmas as his birthday. But what Christians did about the 5th century was to take over and Christianize an already existing nature festival. It was the one that marked the winter solstice in the Northern Hemisphere. It celebrated the day when the sun would begin to return with greater heat and longer days. And so that festival, you see, was another version of the Easter theme. And the slogan of the day was Sol Invictus, the unconquerable sun. And Christians saw those words to be particularly apt for them. And so they chose the day to celebrate the coming of Jesus Christ. Now, the Christmas festival remains today much more popular than Easter, because without any guidance from anyone, society has been unconsciously engaged in changing its character. Now, those who wish to celebrate it as the birthday of the supposed Saviour of the world are still free to do so. But for the majority of people in our world, that's not what it means anymore. Even though the outward trappings remain the same, angelic choirs, the shepherds, the Bethlehem manger, the three wise men, what Christmas has become is a time of giving and receiving gifts in a spontaneous outpouring of peace and goodwill. And above all, it's the one season of the year when all families try to get together again. Now, the fostering of family life is something to be encouraged. It's the celebration of something very important in the natural world, our very humanity, including the evolution of human culture, has been made possible because we are nurtured in families, generation after generation. But of course, we in the Southern Hemisphere have special problems with both of these festivals. You see, we celebrate Easter in the autumn when it ought to be in the spring. And even Christmas is more appropriate in the winter, because the cold and darkness of the winter have the effect of encouraging the family to move closer together round a burning fire in the hearth. So some pioneering souls among us are already making attempts to mark the 21st of June as the winter solstice celebration. Such a move is to be encouraged in this ecological age. And should New Zealand become a republic, we could well replace Queen's birthday weekend with the celebration of the winter solstice on the third Monday of June. Now, until modern times, the Christian Church has been the official promoter and guardian of our community festivals. But because it unfortunately became increasingly divorced from the natural world and interpreted human life in otherworldly terms, it now has a lot of unlearning to do before it can give to our ecological age the spiritual lead that is so badly needed. You see, paradoxically, the church has to be prepared to experience in itself its own most basic message, the Easter message. Just as the Lord, it proclaims, was prepared to die to his former life, so the church must be prepared to die to its former life, that it may be resurrected to new vitality for the ecological age. And before it is too late, the church has the opportunity to reorientate its most frequent festival, the Sunday service. We've already noted that the 7-day week goes back to the ancient Canaanites, being the unit of the Canaanite agricultural calendar. The chief reason why it has survived through later Jewish, Christian, and Muslim tradition was because one day in seven was observed as a day of rest. It has been celebrated in a great variety of ways through history, the Jewish Sabbath, the Christian Lord's Day, the Muslim Holy Day, and now a secular holiday. But it's never lost its original purpose, a day of rest from normal work. That's why it was called the Sabbath, or cessation. Originally also, it meant rest from labour not only for humans but for animals, and not only for creatures but for the land. The processes of nature all had to have their rest if they were to continue to produce fruits for humankind. And the existence of the sabbatical year shows that the ancient Canaanite agriculturalists had already learned the value of letting the land lie fallow. In many respects, the 7-day week with the institution of one of them as a day of rest, is the most enduring cultural gift we have inherited from ancient Canaan. In spite of the secularization of the Sabbath, this day of rest remains firmly embedded in our culture, and through Christian and Muslim influence, it is now becoming worldwide. What we are in danger of losing, however, is the positive spiritual direction which were given to it by Jew, Christian, and Muslim. Rest from labour, whether manual or mental, we still value more than ever. It provides for the recreation of energy in mind and body. But what Jew, Christian, and Muslim added to this by their various forms of worship was the recreation of spirit. In order to get the best out of life, we all benefit from regular occasions when we take stock of ourselves, clarify our aims in life, admit our mistakes, and resolve to make a new beginning. And that's what the various spiritual practices did for Jew, Christian, and Muslim. And if we are to face the coming ecological crisis with a positive and constructive attitude, the reorientation of the Sunday service can greatly nurture and spread green consciousness. And it actually requires less change than at first sight would appear. It would still be a form of worship. That is, an acknowledgement of all that is of supreme worth to us. Because as Thomas Berry points out, there is an awe and a reverence due to the stars and the heavens and the sun and the heavenly bodies, to the seas and the continents, to all living forms of trees and flowers, to the myriad expressions of life in the sea, to the animals of the forest and the birds of the air. To wantonly destroy a living species is to silence forever a divine voice. So there would still be a place for reflecting on our cultural origins, and that's what the Bible readings long provided. And there will be a place for meditation, and that's what the prayers long provided. And there will still be a place for mental stimulation, and that is what the sermon was supposed to provide. It's the content rather than the form that needs to change. Ecological spirituality will focus on the nature of our relatedness, not only to one another as humans in human society, but to all living forms of life in the ecosphere and to the forces of nature themselves. And there will be an important place for the singing of songs. You may think that what we sing is of no real significance. Not so. That may be illustrated by observing that the reason why the Protestant Reformation spread so rapidly through Northern Europe, it was not so much by teaching as by singing. For that is when congregational singing really took off. And Pope Urban III complained that Martin Luther had sung the church into heresy. Now, in a similar way, the evangelical revival under the Wesley brothers spread through its singing. And to this day, the religious beliefs of churchgoers are shaped more by their hymns than by the sermons they hear. You see, it's been well said, religion is not so much taught as caught. And already, appropriate hymns are being composed, particularly by New Zealand's best-known hymn writer, Shirley Murray. So the Reformed Sunday worship will celebrate everything we have come to value in human existence, such as the importance of healthy human relationships, the rich inheritance of human culture. And in these days of declining church attendance, the reason why some people still go to church in spite of the obsolete nature of the words often used is the fellowship and the mutual support they find there. And we should note in this respect the great change that has already taken place in the way Christians celebrate their chief ritual, known variously as Holy Communion, the Lord's Supper, or the Eucharist. Over the last four centuries, it has been interpreted less and less as the commemoration of a sacrifice offered on an altar to God, as it was in the Middle Ages, and more as the sharing of a common meal round a table. And even the Catholic Church has made significant moves in this direction since the Vatican II Council. This ritual originated among the ancient Semitic nomads. They placed great emphasis on hospitality and on the way a meal nurtured community. It's gone through many forms, of course, some for better and some for worse, but it can still nurture and celebrate the rich character of human fellowship. But the ritual that has already changed most during the 20th century has been the funeral service. It is fast ceasing to be the official send-off to the next world and has become the celebration of a life that has ended in this world. Similarly, though this practice has hardly yet begun, the ritual of infant baptism can be changed from being the cleansing from original sin, as it once used to be, to the welcoming of new life within the family. And then confirmation will be replaced by a ritual in which growing adolescents acknowledge their adult responsibilities both to their fellow humans and to the ecosphere, because in these secular days, about the only form that there is getting your driving license. Now, as the religious activities of the past are reformed to meet the needs of the ecological age, more and more relevant forms will be created, equivalent to what were created in the past. Now, one of the great creations in the past was, in fact, the Ten Commandments. It was an inspired creation at the time, and that's why it's lasted so long. And there are frequent calls to have it returned. But good as it was in the past, it is no longer relevant to the ecological age, not least because of the very word commandment is no longer suitable. Today we are free people. We choose our behaviour out of inner conviction. And yet, as green Christianity responds to the ecological imperative, it may also well compose statements of intent to replace the creeds of the past. So I conclude by offering one. 10 resolutions which could help us build a healthy world to hand on to those who follow us. Let us take time to stand in awe of the self-evolving universe. Let us marvel at the living ecosphere of this planet. Let us set a supreme value on all forms of life. Let us develop a lifestyle that preserves the balance of the planetary ecosystem. Let us refrain from all activities that endanger the future of any species. Let us devote ourselves to the maximizing the future for all living creatures. Let us set the needs of the coming global society before those of ourselves, our society, or nation. Let us learn to value the human relationships that bind us together into social groups. And let us learn to appreciate the total cultural legacy we have received from the past. Let us accept, in a self-sacrificing fashion, the responsibility now laid upon us for the future of all species and of all planetary life. And so ends this sketch of the greening of Christianity.